don't even check it, right? It's fine. It's good. Alright. Shabbat Shalom, brothers and sisters. Before I start today's drash, I'd like to start by looking into an internal mechanism within our brains. It's called cognitive dissonance. Bring up the slide, please. In the field of psychology, cognitive dissonance is the perception of contradictory information. Relevant items or information include a person's actions, feelings, ideas, beliefs, values, and things in the environment. Cognitive dissonance is typically experienced as psychological stress when persons participate in an action that goes against one or more of these things. According to this theory, when two actions or ideas are not psychologically consistent with each other, people do all in their power to change them until they become consistent. The discomfort is triggered by a person's belief clashing with new information perceived, wherein the individual tries to find a way to resolve the contradiction to reduce their discomfort. This is the main problem that we all suffer from when learning Yah's word. Over the past 2,000 years, both Jews and Christians have bent and twisted Yah's word to fit their particular denomination. The reality is, Yah does not change, and it is us that have to remold, to be remolded in the likeness and similitude of Yeshua. It is us that needs to change our lives and to come into line with Torah, and not the Torah that needs to fit into our lives. Yeshua came to give us a living example of how we are to live our lives according to the spirit and the truth of Torah. Or as Shaul would put it in Romans 12:2, "Do not be conformed to this age, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, for you to prove what is the good and well-pleasing and perfect will of Yehovah." This is much more difficult than it may seem. The perfect will of Yehovah is that you would bring yourself into complete obedience with the Torah. To do this, we must all overcome our own cognitive dissonance. Next slide. We've just spent the last few weeks learning about Yaakov's life. So today I'm going to show you about what the prophets refer to as the time of Jacob's trouble. Much of what I'm going to present to you today may differ greatly from what you have been taught about the history of the world and Yah's people. Remember what cognitive dissonance is. When an idea is presented that conflicts with your belief structure, you will try and bend the information presented to fit your theology or belief system. I implore you, become like little children for the next hour and try and see the history of the world from a different perspective. Let us start with a foundation scripture for understanding all of history, past, present and future. It comes to us in Amos 3:7. "Surely Yehovah your Elohim does nothing without revealing his plan to his servants, the prophets." Within the Hebraic prophetic narrative, all of history has been pre-recorded. Let me say that again. Within the Hebraic prophetic narrative, all of history has been pre-recorded. We must try and understand the history of the world through this narrative, and not from what we have been taught through the current Babylonian system that we live. Today I'm going to look at what the prophets refer to, the time of Jacob's trouble. I'm going to focus on two parts of this week's Torah portion. The first I actually covered in the last time I told a drash, and it's from Bereshit, or Genesis 49:10. "The scepter shall not part from Yehuda, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people." The second is from Bereshit, or Genesis 48:19. But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." I covered this first scripture in depth during my last drash, like I said. The scepter or Torah giver will not depart from Yehuda until Shiloh comes. In other words, we are to pay due respect to Yehuda As to his position of authority with regards to Torah, until we return to the Mishkan or the tabernacle in the wilderness. This second prophecy is much more difficult to translate over time. Yah is constantly going over these two tribes through his servants the prophets over and over again. Ephraim Yehuda, Ephraim Yehuda. Well, today I'm going to show you how this fits into the history of the creation and the Word. Let's take a deeper look at Bereshit Genesis 48:19. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He shall become a people, and he also shall become great. But truly his younger brother, Ephraim, shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become Melo HaGoyim, or the Gentiles. Now this prophecy should start jumping off the page at you, as the Greek scriptures are constantly talking about the Gentiles. Let's take a look at what this prophecy says and how it fits into the context of the world and what the prophets call the time of Jacob's trouble. When we study the shadows of Jacob's life, we can begin to understand how Yah uses the prophets to paint a picture of history and how it was to unfold. Jacob states in Bereshit Genesis 32:10, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two camps. So according to Jacob, or Jacob, he was two camps. This makes sense, as we also know that Jacob had two wives, Leah and Rachel, who bore Yehuda and Joseph respectively. Out of Joseph comes Ephraim. Leah is prophetically Yehuda, and Rachel is Ephraim. Next slide. These are some of the major events of Jacob's life, and thus the major events during the time of Jacob's trouble. As I said, the first wife was Leah, from which comes Yehuda. The second wife was Rachel, from which we get Joseph or Ephraim. He had a diversity of sheep, which were every different speckled spot, much like the speckled different nations and races under Yehovah. The changes of the wages multiple times was a time of great deception, and it culminated in a change in name from Jacob to Yisrael. Yah does not change ever. None of his prophets ever added to or took away from his Torah. Every prophetic utterance can be brought back to an idea first raised in Torah. This is why all the prophets are in perfect alignment with Yehovah. They will only ever expand on Torah, being careful not to add to nor take away from it. The time of Jacob's trouble comes to us first through Jeremiah 30:4-10. And these are the words of Yehovah spoke concerning Israel and concerning Yehuda. For thus says Yehovah, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask ye now, and see whether a man does travail with child. Wherefore do I see every man on his hands, on his loins, as a woman in travail, and all faces are turned into paleness. Alas, for the day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be dissaved out of it. For it shall come to pass in that day, says Yehovah of hosts, that I will break his yoke from off your neck, and will burst your bonds, and strangers shall no more serve themselves of him, but they shall serve Yehovah their Elohim, and David their king, whom I will raise up unto them. Therefore fear not, O my servant Jacob, says Yehovah. Neither be dismayed, O Israel. For lo, I will save you from afar, and your seed from a land of their captivity. And Jacob shall return, and shall be in rest, and be quiet, and none shall make him afraid. Wow, what a beautiful picture. Did you catch it? A time of great distress, as a woman in travail. And Yah will deliver us out of it. Today I'm going to show you how this is coming to fruition in our days. It gives us hope as we watch this world descend into utter darkness. that Yehovah is fulfilling the last of the prophetic events of Jacob's life, so that we can leave this Babylonian system behind and walk into the millennial kingdom. At the culmination of this time, David, our king, will be raised up to us, and we'll be free from the bondage of this oppressive system that we live today. Okay, so let's take a look at the history of Israel. Next slide. After the time of Solomon, the kingdom of Israel was divided into two, the house of Israel in the north and the house of Yehuda in the south. Yehuda had the temple, and the house of Israel had Shiloh, which was erected in Ephraim. We read that it was Jacob himself that said he was two camps, and yet here we have it unfolding in history. Jacob's life was full of tribulation. He struggled in his faith, and thus his walk. He even admits as much in Bereshit, Genesis 47:9. And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not obtained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers, in the days of their pilgrimage." Few and evil, he says, the days of his life have been, and thus he did not obtain to the years of the lives of his fathers in their pilgrimage. Thus, the time of Jacob's trouble is filled with tribulation and disobedience. This is a parable for the disobedience of Yehuda and Ephraim for the last 2,000 years. The kingdom was divided into two camps. Yet Yah allowed for a time for the two kingdoms to live in together in relative harmony until Yehovah warns his people that he will break this brotherhood in Zechariah 11:14. "Then I will cut into my other staff bonds, that I may break the brotherhood between Yehuda and Israel." The house of Israel continued to operate Shiloh, the tabernacle that was in the wilderness, regardless of being continually warned by Yah that they were being disobedient in doing so. Led by Ephraim, the house of Israel engaged in all sorts of profane activities that was against the Torah, including the worship of Moloch and Baal. Eventually Yah had had enough, so he spoke to Jeremiah in Jeremiah 3:6-8. "Yehovah said also to me in the days of Josiah the king, 'Have you seen what backsliding Israel has done? She has gone up on every high mountain and under every green tree, and there played the harlot.' And I said, 'After she had done all these things, return to me.' But she did not. She did not return. And her treacherous sister Yehuda saw it. Then I saw that for all the causes for which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I put her away and gave her a certificate of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Yehuda did not fear, but went and played the harlot also." Yah divorced the house of Israel. To be divorced from Yah is a judgment of death. You will notice that it was only the northern kingdom that was divorced. There is nowhere in the entirety of Scripture where Yah divorces Yehuda. Not one prophet anywhere. Let me say that again. There is nowhere in the entirety of Scripture where Yah divorces Yehuda. Not one prophet anywhere. Yah confirms this in Isaiah 51. "Thus says Yehovah, where is the certificate of your mother's divorce, whom I have put away? Or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? For your iniquities you have sold yourselves, and for your transgressions your mother has been put away." There is some confusion within the body of believers with the difference between putting a wife away and a certificate of divorce. There are many reasons within Torah where a husband would need to put his wife away for a period of time. Not all of them are for disobedience or for adultery. Yah sent Yehuda away a number of times for her disobedience, but never gave them a divorce. if you live in the land and don't run it according to the Torah, it will eventually vomit you out, as it did to Yehuda many times. Moshe gives us the statutes for divorce in Devarim or Deuteronomy 24:1-4. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house when she has departed from his house, and goes and becomes another man's wife. If the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as a wife, as his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back again, back to be his wife, after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before Yehovah, and you shall not bring sin on the land which Yehovah your Elohim is giving you as an inheritance. Once the house of Israel started worshipping Baal and Moloch, they had taken upon themselves a new husband, and thus Abba could never take them back again. Yeshua was trying to clear up this confusion around divorce when he spoke in Luke 16:18. Everyone putting away his wife and marrying another commits adultery, and the one marrying her put away from her husband commits adultery. See, to put away your wife is not divorce at all. If you marry someone who is put away, you are still married to the first husband, and thus you just committed adultery. Yehuda, even though they were put away, they were never actually divorced. They repented and were eventually allowed into Yah's land. And then along comes Yeshua the bridegroom. As Yeshua is the son of Abba and not actually Abba, as such he is an eligible bridegroom for the house of Israel or Ephraim to be married to. Yeshua says it himself in Matthew 15:24. But he answered and said, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, or in other words, Ephraim. Yes, Yeshua came for the house of Israel, or Ephraim as you like, otherwise known as the Gentiles. This brings us back full circle to this week's Torah portion in Genesis 48:19. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly, his younger brother Ephraim shall be greater than him, and his descendants shall become the Melo HaGoyim, or the Gentiles. We all struggle with identity in this world. Biblically, if you believe in Yeshua ben Joseph, then you are Ephraim, or the sons of Ephraim, and you are Hebrews. Alright, off to a slightly different topic, but still completely relevant. How many olive trees are there? Well, according to Zechariah, there are two olive trees in Zechariah 4:1-4. Now the angel who talked with me came back and woke me as a man who is awakened out of his sleep, and he said to me, what do you see? So I said, I am looking, and there is a menorah of solid gold with a bowl on it, on top of it, and on the menorah seven lamps with seven pipes to the seven lamps. Two olive trees are by it, one on the right side of the bowl and the other on the left. Yes, that's right, two olive trees either side of the menorah. This is my favorite section of the prophets and has been my backdrop for all my presentations. Why? Because of this next slide. This is a depiction of what Zechariah saw. Yes, that's right. Two olive trees, one of Yehuda and one of Ephraim. And in the middle, Mashiach. The olive tree of Ephraim was cut down when she was divorced from Yah through Jeremiah. Yeshua confirmed that there are two olive trees in John 17:6. I have manifested my name, your name, to the men whom you have given me out of the world. They were yours, O Yehuda, and you gave them to me, Ephraim, and they have kept your word. And then again in John 10:16. And other sheep, Ephraim, I have, which are not of this fold, Yehuda. Them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, the Torah, and they will be one flock and one shepherd. If you shema what Yeshua is saying here, he says that there will be one flock and one shepherd. This is future tense and not present tense. Yet in Yeshua ben Joseph, we have a new tree for Ephraim. This was prophesied by Isaiah in 11:1. Then a shoot will spring up from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. Yeshua allows Ephraim to become whole again. He is the root and the foundation from which Ephraim has grown into a new tree. Once we have this understanding, other parts of the prophets will literally jump to life. Like this one in Isaiah 54:1. Shout for joy, O barren woman, who bears no children. Break forth in song and cry aloud, you who have never travailed. Because more of the children of the desolate woman, Ephraim, than of her who was a husband, who has a husband, Yehuda, says Jehovah. The children of Ephraim outnumber the Jews significantly. I will show you how this works a little later. First, two camps, then two olive trees, and now two wives. It's literally everywhere once you start opening up your eyes to it. Yeshua confirmed this, again, with his parable of the prodigal son in Luke 15:11. Then Yeshua said, there was a man who had two sons. The younger son, Ephraim, said to him, Father, give me my share of the estate, so that he divided the property between them. After a few days, the younger son, Ephraim, got everything together and journeyed to a distant country, and he squandered his wealth with wild living. After he had spent all he had, a severe famine swept through the country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to the citizens of that land, that country, who sent him into the field to feed the pigs. He longed to fill his belly with the pods the pigs were eating, but no one would give them to him, a thing. Finally, he came to his senses and said, how many of my father's hired servants have plenty of food? But here I am, starving to death. I will get up and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still in the distance, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran to his son Ephraim, embraced him and kissed him. The son, Ephraim, declared, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servant, quick, bring the best robes and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let us feast and celebrate. For this son of mine, Ephraim, was dead and is alive again. And he was lost and he is found. So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son, Yehuda, who was in the field, and as he approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what was going on. Your brother, Ephraim, has returned, he said, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older son, Yehuda, became angry and refused to go in. So his father came out and pleaded with him. And he answered his father, look, all these days I have served you and never disobeyed a commandment of yours. Yet you ever gave me even a young goat so that I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son, Ephraim, of yours, has squandered your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. Son, Yehuda, you are always with me, the father said, and all that is mine is yours. But it was fitting to celebrate and be glad, because this brother Ephraim of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. There is a day when these two trees will become one again. But this event has not happened yet. It's written about in Ezekiel 37:19. Say to them, thus says Yehovah your Elohim, surely I will take the stick or tree of Yosef, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel his companions, and I will join them with it to the stick or the tree of Yehuda, and make them one stick or tree, and they will become one in my hand. I put the stick tree up there because the Hebrew word can be translated either as stick or tree or both. So that's why I put it up there, because Ezekiel would have had sticks in his hand, so they were sticks, but prophetically they were trees. Now back to the history of the world. Let's take a look at the statue of Daniel. Next slide. The head of the statue of Daniel is Babylon. The chest and arms of silver is the Medo-Persian Empire. After this came the waste of brass of the Grecian-Macedonian Empire. Interesting, it was Alexander Pol Pot who conquered by assimilating the culture of the land. This is a trait that was carried out. Is it back on? Yep. And the Roman Empire. The mystery is, what is the feat of iron and clay? Well, with all things, it's the Torah, it's that will tell us what the answers are. Jeremiah confirms who this clay is in Jeremiah 31:9. O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter, says Jehovah? Look, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel. This is confirmed by Isaiah in Isaiah 64:8. But now, O Jehovah, you are our father, we are the clay, you are our potter, and all we are the work of your hands. The call of the last days is to come out of her, first recorded by Jeremiah in 51:54. Come out of her, my people. Save your lives, each of you, from the fierce anger of Jehovah. And in Revelation in 18:4. Then I heard a voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. The inclination here is his people are somewhere where he does not want them to be. The context of these scriptures is Babylon. The plague is not COVID. It's this vaccine thing. Pushed on us by a Babylonian Egyptian medical system that believes that they are trying to protect us from it. Your protection comes from Yehovah. Do not fear. It's written that you should not fear him who can kill the body, but him who can kill the ruach. With this in mind, clay is the house of Israel, or if you like, Ephraim. Next slide. With the advent of Yeshua, Ephraim became clay again. And shortly after Yeshua's ministry, the Roman Empire was being torn apart from by the So what did Rome do? They merged Babylon with the Hebrew Ephraim. And so we have the final kingdom, Christianity. Ephraim was now hidden within the Christian framework. This maintained up until around 20 years ago, when the prodigal son woke up in the pig's den, that's Babylon, and started the trek back to the father's house. The great awakening is happening, and they are coming out of her, prophetically. Daniel elaborates on these toes and gives further strength to this argument in Daniel 4:1-4. And as the toes of the feet are partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will partly strong, Catholicism, and partly divided, Protestantism. As you saw the iron mix with clay, so the people will mix with one another, but will not hold together more than iron mixes with clay. It's interesting, last week I was practicing this with my wife, and she's like, but Daniel says it's toes of the feet. And I was meditating on it all week, trying to figure out what Yah was saying. And he was telling me to look at the process of time. The statue of Daniel is the history of the world. And as you travel down, from the time of Nebuchadnezzar, as you travel down the statue from the head to the toes, it's the progress of time. The feet, as I said, is the Christian Empire. The toes, the revelation he gave me was, this was the time of the Protestant Reformation. The start of Christianity was some 2,000 years ago, the Reformation was only 500 years ago. It's a process of time. As I said, the prophets recorded all of this before it happened. Whose job is it to bring these two trees back together again? Well, most believers in Yeshua would say that's Yeshua's job. Unfortunately, the scriptures disagree with that idea, and so does Yeshua. Let's look first at Malachi 4:1-6. For behold, the day is coming, burning like a furnace, when all the arrogant and evildoers will be stubble. The day is coming when I will set them ablaze, says Jehovah of hosts. Not a root or branch will be left of them. But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will arise with healing in its wings. And you will go out and leap like calves from the stall. Then you will trample the wicked, for they will be ashes under the soles of your feet on the day that I am preparing, says Jehovah of hosts. Remember the Torah of my servant Moses, the statutes and ordinances I commanded him for all Israel in Horeb. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and awesome day of Jehovah, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. Otherwise I will come and strike the land with a curse. Now this section of Malachi can be translated slightly differently to read like this at the bottom in Malachi 4:5-6. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and awesome day of Jehovah, and he will restore the hearts of the father, Abba Yehuda, to the son, Yeshua Ephraim, and the hearts of the son, Yeshua Ephraim, to the father, Abba Yehuda. Otherwise I will come and strike the lamb with a curse. It's a prophet's job to speak Yah's word, yes. But they are also sent to correct the course of history. Yah says right here that it's up to Elijah to bridge the gap between Yehuda and Ephraim. You can try all you like to convince the Jews about Yeshua, and you may have some success. But in the end, it's Elijah's job to bridge them together, to bring them together. Yeshua himself confirms that this job of joining the two trees together is a job for Elijah in Matthew 17:10-11. The disciples ask him, why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? Yeshua replies, Elijah does indeed come, and he will restore all things. Yes, that's right. Yeshua says that it's Elijah's job to restore all things. Most messianics come out of Christianity. With that, we all know that we have inherited lies and falsehoods. At this time of the year, it is a stark reminder of where we've come from, and it can at times be painful. You can grain heart that this is all prophesied in advance in Hosea 11:10-12. They will walk after Yehovah. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, the children will come trembling from the west. They will come trembling like birds from Egypt, and like doves from the land of Assyria. Then I will settle them in their homes, declares Yehovah. Ephraim surrounds me with lies. The house of Israel did deceit. Yet Yehuda still walks with Elohim and is faithful with the Holy One. Yes, we inherited lies. But you have woken up as a prodigal son in the pig den that is Babylon, and are making the trek back to Yehovah's house. You are Hebrews of the house of Ephraim, grafted in by Yeshua ben Joseph, your Mashiach. Next slide. In conclusion, there are two wives, two camps, and two olive trees. The first wife, Yehuda, the second, Ephraim. You are sheep of every type, creed, language, race, just as Jacob's flock was speckled and spotted. This Babylonian system has continually changed your wages, just as Laban did with Jacob, and have done this through the modern banking system. Christianity has deceived the entire world with their mixture of Babylon and Hebrew religion, just as Jacob's life was full with great deception. But just as Jacob passed over the Jordan and was renamed Israel, we too will be leaving in a greater exodus and become one nation under Yah again, Israel. He will bring us all back together again. How? Well, that's yet to be seen, and to be quite frank, it's above our pay grades. We must be faithful to the very end so that we can be deemed worthy to inherit the kingdom of Yah. Any questions? No? Yeah, comment, questions?
I promised. Testing one, okay. Yes, I probably should have put that background with the two trees and the menorah between it.
Yeah.
Because I know the menorah was fed from oil,
mm-hmm.
and that with the bowl, that they were surrounding the bowl, and the bowl was filled with oil, and that supplied that wicked the fuel up to that. And I've never seen that. And I'm wondering where that came from, and the conception that it's not a flat menorah in that form that we see so commonly, as if it's a thing that's been carved on a wall. Representing it, but that image was just quite amazing to me. It sort of solved the mechanical process that's involved in having it all work.
Yeah.
Thank you. But where did it come from?
Where did the bowl come from? Oh, the actual picture itself. You mean the picture or the idea of a bowl? The picture.
Somebody expressed it very well.
So the picture, if you go back to the picture, it shows you where I got it from. It's called the Ministry of the Two Prophets. That's where I got the picture from. But it's actually written in scripture that there was a bowl there, so that's why they've done it that way.
Yep.
So,
I love your questions.
So, the question I have is for you is that why did divorce the other side?
Yehuda.
Well, yeah.
Well, because Yeshua had to come through Yehuda. And if he was born in a divorced marriage, he's thus in sin when he's born. And he had to be spotless. So Yehuda could not be divorced until after Yeshua was born. And there's no prophet after then that says they're divorced. So they're still married.
Okay, you just confirmed what I knew, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Can I?
Yep.
I believe that the Messianic community that have come out of Judaism and of Christianity and going back to Torah is the beginning of them combining. So, because that's what's going to happen eventually.
Mm.
That both Christianity and Judah will be joined as one.
Mm.
And that's what we are.
Mm.
We are people of all different religions, and some are out of Judaism.
Mm.
And so that's just the beginning. And we're in a position where we follow only Torah, and we follow only the Word, and we don't follow the doctrines of man that have been added by both. So that's the beginning of what Elijah will do when he comes before Yeshua returns to bring them both together.
Yeah, like I said, you may have some success. Is that muted? You may have some success converting the Jew across, but ultimately the end job is Elijah's job.
Yeah.
And that's not to stop you from trying to do it, to talk to the Jews about Yeshua. And some of them may turn, come over, and that's great. But that last sort of linking of the two, that's his job.
But the Ruach HaKodesh also does it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
And that's
it stirs within each person.
Yeah.
When you're talking to someone about Yeshua, even a Jew, and they get stirred and they start looking into it, then that's that process happening.
That's exactly right. And that's why when we started Beit Gan Eden, we were told never to bring people in. They had to be led by the Ruach HaKodesh.
Mm. And then once they're here, that's up to them whether they stay. That's the whole parable of the seed falling on different ground.
So it says it's going to be a great revival. So what Tamar is saying there will be a great revival through our children.
Mm.
So that will happen sometime in the near future.
We have to believe.
Yes.
Well, whether that happens before the kingdom is set up or after, when the millennial kingdom's in place, there is people that are coming into the kingdom from outside. It says the Torah shall go forth from Zion, and they'll be sent out to all the world to collect his people. So maybe the revival is after, because Yeshua also says that few it is that make it through that narrow path.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the start of it, like that's the few you're talking about tomorrow that get through that path at the start. Because there's plenty of inclination that those that are first through, there's a greater reward for those that bear through the tribulation, and then there's those that come through the tribulation and come in later. So whether it's before or after is, again, it's above our pay grades. We don't know. He knows. Like Yeshua said, he doesn't even know the time or the day, so these are things we don't need to worry about.
Yeah.
But they're interesting to talk about for sure. Any other questions? All right, let's start the Yeshua remembrance.